Heavy is the head that wears the crown. This is probably the mantra that Herod was muttering to himself as John's body was carried away on the shoulders of his disciples. If people only knew, Herod must have thought, if people only knew what kinds of pressure he was under, all the different directions that he was being pulled in, how many different people he must please, then they might settle down and behave. No one considers the delicate and deadly position that Herod and his royal family are in. The head of a puppet government, propped up by Caesar to keep some semblance of control over unruly subjects, the Jews of Israel. No one considers how difficult it must be to be in Herod's position. I'm sure this is what he's thinking. He must give just the right amount of deference, each in turn, to the emperor, the temple, and the people. Just a hair's breadth too much or too little, and he might be ousted by a mob or strung up by one of Caesar's officers. No one bothers to recognize, Herod probably thinks, that it is his life and his wife's life and his children's lives that are perpetually at risk as he goes about his work in the palace. What else was Herod supposed to do, after all, when John the Baptist came out of the woodwork to make a scandal of him as a Jew and a mockery of him as a king? Did not Herod's own life hang in the balance of John's insults? Heavy is the head that wears the crown. Mark's account of Herod in chapter 6 reveals to us a monarch that certainly doesn't see himself as uniquely cruel or violent. King Herod Antipas, who we see here in Mark 6, is arguably a more nuanced character than his father, King Herod the Great, who in Matthew's gospel issues his edict to kill all male infants in the land. Very unlike Matthew 2, there is no fury, no indiscriminate bloodlust here in Mark 6. Instead, we see in Herod Antipas a cunning political savvy, a penchant to appease, to compromise, and to keep the peace. One can imagine that Herod saw his own relaxed and polished demeanor as a great improvement over his father's. In fact, his father was known to have killed many of his own family members, including some of the younger Herod's own siblings. And so Herod probably felt like a sensitive soul relative to the rest of his family. And so in the Herod of Mark 6, we also see this strange penchant for enchantment. His eyes were wide open. He saw that John was a holy and righteous man. He could see it more clearly than his wife could, anyhow. He couldn't let John go on ranting about his marriage in public, but in his cell, he tried to keep the Baptist relatively comfortable and keep him company from time to time. Verse 20 says that when Herod listened to John, he was greatly perplexed. He heard what John had to say, and his heart was stirred. Where Herodias, his wife, only heard trouble in John's words, Herod heard John's call to live simply and righteously, and I can imagine that the client king envied John's no-nonsense attitude and the clarity of his vision. For someone who had survived his father's reign as well as Roman rule by being aloof and agreeable, I suspect that Herod was a little in awe of John in his ability to fearlessly name the ills he saw in the world and call for wrongs to be righted, for paths to be made straight. Unfortunately, Herod's enchantment was wide-ranging, and his eyes were also wide open to his stepdaughter's dancing. As he makes an oath to the young girl, offering her half his kingdom, one can imagine that Herod sees himself as quite generous, attuned to the arts and attentive to his blended family. It seems he was so enchanted, he failed to see how his generosity could so quickly spell the death of the prisoner he had come to admire. And so what I'm trying to emphasize here, and what I think Mark might be trying to emphasize, is that Herod, despite how he would come to be etched in history, is relatively unremarkable in character. He was decidedly less tyrannical than his father and seemed on a personal level to have a sort of agreeable, maybe even congenial disposition. He was a bureaucrat, one who knew the rules well, even the unwritten ones, and he sensed that while he could use these rules to shield himself from danger and occasionally increase his riches, he was far from being able to do whatever he pleased. In fact, when Herodias' daughter came back in with her request, Herod had to do the one thing he least wanted to do. There was no getting out of it from Herod's point of view. He had made his oath. His hands were tied. Heavy is the head that wears the crown. This story and the poignant depiction of a figure as ominous as King Herod reminds me of a story told by the writer Hannah Arendt in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. Hannah Arendt was a Jewish woman who was able to flee Nazi Germany, and she ended up making her career in the United States as a philosopher and a political theorist and a historian and a general writer. And in 1961, she attended and reported on the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who is largely known as the architect of the Holocaust and who had been hunted down and captured and was now being tried in Jerusalem for his crimes against humanity. And during the trial, Arendt was struck by Eichmann's unsettling ordinariness. He was forthcoming during questioning and fully acknowledging his responsibility in the horrors of mass murder, but not really seeing any way he could have or should have acted any differently. The political machinery was just larger than he was, he argued. He was an ambitious man and wanted to do well in his career and wanted to get along in the world that Germany was creating. He figured he had made his oath, and his hands were tied. Arendt writes in her book that the trouble with Eichmann was precisely that so many were like him, and that the many were neither perverted nor sadistic, that they were and still are terribly and terrifyingly normal. He was not stupid. It was sheer thoughtlessness, something by no means identical with stupidity, that predisposed him to become one of the greatest criminals of that period. Thoughtlessness, sheer thoughtlessness, a failure to imagine himself acting outside the boundaries, the political boundaries, the professional boundaries that he moved and lived and breathed in, a failure to imagine himself acting outside of the story that his country had been telling him for so long. I think we see in Mark that Herod suffers from a very similar failure of imagination. He simply cannot imagine himself acting outside of his political allegiances, outside of the family tensions that make up his world. He knows John is righteous. He knows that he's holy. John's words have stirred up his heart and perplexed him. But the righteousness that John preached, the way of living that he demanded from Herod, Herod just could not square with the status quo of his world. And so he let John, probably the only source of light and truth in his life, be cut down and be silenced. And I must admit, as I read and reread this passage with its intimate details into Herod's inner life, I find his thought process, not his actions necessarily, but his thought process, to be hauntingly familiar. How often do I allow the voices of righteousness and truth in my life to be caged up and placed in a little box that I might approach at my leisure and chat with and banter with until the words become too close to home? How often do I respond to the prophets in my life that what they are asking of me simply cannot be done, that it's too idealistic, too impractical, that the calculus of this world will not allow it? How often do I let the stories told in the news cycle, or the stories told amongst my friends, or the story told on my paycheck, limit what I imagine God is asking me to do? As I read and reread this passage, I find Herod's decision-making process to be terribly and terrifyingly normal. But within this passage, within Mark 6, there is a subtle irony that is slowly unfolding. And it begins unfolding with the first mention of this potential resurrection of John. The bulk of this text, the bulk of this story, is tragic and painful in the life and ministry of Jesus. And Mark's audience of persecuted Christians who were living right around the time the temple was destroyed, they would relate well to the tragedy of this story, and they would feel it in a heavy way. But there is a catch right at the end of our passage that alerts Mark's readers that something else is going on here. The final verse reads, "When the disciples heard about it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb." I can imagine a twinkle in Mark's eye as he was writing these words, because this is exactly how the disciples retrieved Jesus' body at the end of Mark. First asking Pilate for it, and then coming and carrying it away and placing it in a tomb. A tomb which famously is empty. By connecting the tomb of John to the empty tomb of Christ, I think Mark is inviting his readers to view one story as happening within the other. The full tomb of John is not our final word. It is the empty tomb of the resurrected Christ that is the story that shines into the darkened windows of our hearts. It is the story that decides what is possible for God's people. It is the story that decides the scope of our imagination, the story of Christ's empty tomb. It is my prayer this morning, and this morning in particular, that God might show me what stories I have been allowing to frame my life, what stories I have permitted to decide the limits of my imagination for the kind of disciple I'm able to be in the midst of my community, in the midst of my country. It is my prayer also that God might teach me how to use all these stories, in light of his story, which is life, which is reconciliation, which is resurrection. Amen.